Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa and Iowans have long taken pride in our public school system. I can't even begin to tell you how many times when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s, I was told by my teachers or administrators that Iowa has the best schools in the nation. If you grew up in Iowa, you probably heard the same thing. And maybe that was a little bit of Iowa exceptionalism, but the pride was unmistakable. We have inched our way down the rankings of U.S. News and World Report over the years, coming in at 13 right now for pre-K through 12 schools. This year, in particular, has been hard for Iowa schools, and it's not over yet. The COVID-19 pandemic has created incredible challenges, and now legislation proposed by Governor Reynolds would make significant changes to how we operate and fund our public schools. This hour, the history of public education in Iowa, from rural one-room schools to our modern school system. Later in the hour, Margaret Buckton of Iowa School Finance Information Services will walk us through the major changes we've seen in Iowa's public schools in recent decades and help us understand what proposed changes could mean for Iowa's public schools in the future. Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Society, or Historical Museum, will take us back to the beginning of Iowa's public schools. He is on the line with me now. Hi, Leo.
Good morning, Charity. It's great to be with you and your IPI listeners.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's go way back in time. So when settlers came to Iowa and started dividing up the land into homesteads and then trying to educate their children, things were pretty haphazard there for a while. But there were a couple of big moments in history that really shaped the direction for Iowa's public schools. So let's start at the beginning.
Sure. Of course, the land ordinance of 1785, which applied to Iowa as we came in as a territory and then a state, was what established the basis of township schools. But as we became a state in late 1846, our territorial legislature had passed a law on common schools. And it was racist in its foundation, saying that it should be open and free alike to all white persons. So even though we had blacks in our state, our first state laws did not apply to educating black students in our state. Then in 1848, another piece of legislation starts to set up districts, and it's for the education can be made. It doesn't have to, but districts to educate people 5 to 21 years of age. And then the real transformative pieces are 1857, our state constitution is revised. That does make education inclusive, though it still can be segregated. So schools are put under the management of a state board of education, and the Constitution provides that all youths of the state should have access to common schools. So 1857, we acknowledge the rights of black students to be educated, and that then sets the stage for what is truly the earliest transformative act in our state. The Free School Act is what it gets commonly called in 1858, and it's because it provides for free public education for all students and sets up the mechanism that we know today of property taxes being used to support free public education. So within 12 years of statehood, we've, you know, made system that is applied to all children in the state, and that there's a public support mechanism. It also established that there should be at least one high school in each county, but that also then reflects that high school wasn't seen as that critical, that if, you know, a county as big as the counties are in our state, there's only one high school,
right.
That
could be hard
lets
to
you
get
know
to.
That that's not a big deal. Yeah.
Well, and so, of course, students couldn't travel very far to go to school. So to create public education available to all students in Iowa, students were pretty spread out. I mean, we had to have a lot of schools.
Exactly right. And so that law also set up that townships would be districts and that there'd be a superintendent of education for each county. So again, that's part of the 1858 Act. Then that because recognizing that some communities are becoming more and more urban, that a city over 1,000 could create its own district, so you didn't have to just rely, you know, if you were in Sioux City in Woodbury County and getting over 1,000 in population, that you could create your own district. You didn't have to rely on whatever else was happening in your county. And then 1866, that law gets adapted to saying if there's a town or a village that has over 200, they could organize their own school. So up to 1866, that sets the stage for how does the state of Iowa legislate the creation and funding of schools and create an infrastructure with a state superintendent and a superintendent in each county for education. So a fairly early and aggressive effort to create a public education system in our state.
How far could a student be expected to travel to go to a one-room schoolhouse, for example?
Sure. As those district schools, you know, a township is going to be generally either 4x4, sometimes 6 miles. You might be going a couple of miles to get to your local school. And so, you know, going by horse or, you know, the level of walking that was expected by some students, and keeping in mind that the school year generally didn't start until after harvest, especially for boys anyway. So you may not start school till late September, early October. And then as spring work came in, the school year might be wrapping up for some Iowa students by mid-May as work became critical. And that was part of the compulsory school attendance that takes place in the early 1900s, is that it wasn't seen again as critical past eighth grade. But traveling several miles to get to your district one-room school would not be out of the ordinary.
Well, and a lot of that had to be done in the snow and the cold, it sounds like. Of course, we have those dramatic stories about school children and blizzards to look back on. And of course, the teachers would have been in many of these schools, young women who would have had to travel to get to the school early in the morning to start that fire, to get things going on their own. There was a lot of rugged independence involved in getting to those schools.
That certainly was the case. There's a good set of information from a woman named Arizona Perkins, who taught in Polk County in the 1850s and early 1860s. And she talks about the, you know, kind of drudgery of teaching, that you're not just an educator, you're the, you know, building superintendent, at least on a daily basis. And maybe you would ask a older young man, you know, a seventh or eighth grader to help either with wood or coal, depending on what you were burning in the schoolhouse. So those challenges for educators were beyond teaching, just like today.
There was a major event that occurred in 1867 that I know many, many Iowans are very proud of. And that is when Alexander Clark sued to integrate schools in Iowa because his daughter Susan Clark could not attend the local school because she was Black. Tell me more about that landmark case.
Sure, and it really is a story all Iowans should know, and we rightly should be proud of, though, with, you know, the legacy of redlining, still true integration didn't always happen in our schools in Iowa. But in 1867, that fall, Susan had attempted to go to grammar school number 2 in Muscatine. The school board had established a colored school, was the term used in many Iowa communities. Des Moines, Dubuque, Keokuk had segregated schools at that time. And so Alexander Clark had been living in Iowa since the territorial period, had helped organize soldiers in the Civil War to fight on behalf of Iowa Black men, and so really wanted to recognize the rights of his children to attend the same school that had the same qualities as the nearby school. The district court upheld his wish, and it went to the Iowa Supreme Court then in April of 1868. And on April 12, 1868, Justice Cole writes the opinion in Clark versus Muscatine saying, you cannot segregate Iowa schools based on a nationality or a heritage of race, essentially, but he used saying of African descent. And if you can, you know, segregate those students, then you can possibly segregate students with German ancestry or students with Irish ancestry. And there's a lot of prejudice against Irish and to a degree Germans in parts of the state. So That really was transformational, but it's important to keep in mind that Keokuk's high schools were segregated through 1874, and so the Dove and the Smith cases of 1874 and 1875 then ensure that black high school students can go to an integrated high school. So that's 1874 that the Clark case is upheld, though Dubuque is still trying to segregate their elementary school into 1877, and that's the last formal segregated school I know of in Iowa. But the Clark case with Susan Clark and Alexander Clark really does set the stage for equal access to education in Iowa.
And Iowa was the first state in the nation to have a court case like that, that mandated the desegregation of schools, even though, as you point out, it took a while for it to actually happen. Although one of the things that makes me happy looking back at this story is that it did happen in time for Susan Clark to go to Muscatine High School. She was the first African-American graduate of Muscatine High School in 1871.
That's right. And at least as far as I can identify, she's the first high school graduate, black high school graduate in Iowa. So we're on the 150th anniversary this spring of her graduation. So that's something for Iowans to be mindful of.
Now, as all of these things were happening, of course, you know, there were little one-room schools all over the state that were being taught. And a lot of those schools were being taught by very young women. There were male teachers at the start, and then this realization that we just couldn't fill those positions with men. And so teaching became a real opportunity for young women, didn't it?
It really was, and you usually had to be single. Once you were married, oftentimes contracts were canceled if you were a married young woman, and so that was part of the discrimination against some of those early teachers into the 20th century in many cases. And of course, what today is University of Northern Iowa is established in 1876, so we start creating a second or a university college level program. But even that training for teachers really doesn't start to get standardized until the 1880s. And so that's an opportunity for women to get additional training to be educators.
All right, we'll find out more about that in just a moment. This hour, we're taking a look back at the history of public education in the state of Iowa. Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum, is here with us, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are looking back through the history of Iowa's public schools, a public school system that Iowa and Iowans have taken a great deal of pride in over the generations. Coming up in a little while later, we will talk about some of the major changes that have been made to funding of public schools in the last 40 years and how that has changed our public school system in the state. We'll also talk about how recently proposed changes might change our public school system in the future. With me right now, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum, and we've been talking about the development of public schools in Iowa, and we were talking just before the break about how teaching was an opportunity for young women to work outside of the home, which was a tremendous opportunity for a lot of young women to actually make their own money and have some degree of independence. And teacher education also became an important part of that. Now, a lot of the teachers who were teaching in one-room schools only had a high school education themselves, right?
That's correct. And the process starts, as we said, in the 1880s to really standardize the training course for teachers. But often that was the case and what takes place in the progressive era, so the early 1900s into the 19-teens, is that a two-year program is developed. So if young women are going to a high school, within that high school as they're reaching their last 2 years, there's actually a component in the high school curriculum to train young women to be teachers. So that takes place in the about 1910, 1911 as part of that. And at that time, about 85% of the teachers in the state are women. And so you've got this system, as we said, becoming increasingly standardized to certify teachers, make sure that they have a level of knowledge. But of course, if a district was in a spot, they might just hire whoever they could.
And the Iowa State Normal School, so starting to educate teachers, that was founded in 1876. So I'm sure more and more students were drawn there over those decades to get their teaching certification. Was that at that point, was that where people would train to become superintendents or principals? Was that a higher level of expertise?
University of Iowa also trained a lot of those students. And with the teachers, the normal school, or what is today UNI, even that course wasn't a four-year course initially like we think of. It was going to be a one-year or a two-year training program, and then the local superintendent would examine the applicants and hire whoever they thought was the best person for their local school. So that's, you know, part of the challenge, too, that we know into the 20th century, and I think to some of your conversations, like with Roger Maxwell, who went to UNI as a music educator, and because he was a black man, had difficulty getting hired, even though he had a four-year degree.
Yeah. And the education was offered to all students in Iowa. It was supposed to be available to anyone, but how many kids actually went to school? Because that, it wasn't universal, right?
No, it wasn't. The study and that's done in the late 1800s, there was a study in 1889 that showed that about 75% of the eligible students across the state were enrolled, but only 47% of those students actually attended school. So,
wow.
Not even half of our eligible students, but that was because in many cases, young men were needed to do farm work, and that high school wasn't necessarily something that was viewed as critical either.
Right. Well, and you mentioned that we needed to have one high school per county at first. And there was, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a push to make high school education available, at least, to all students. Tell me more about that.
Sure. As part of the same legislation and standards that were put to require teacher certification, the state also then said a district had to support high school attendance for any student who wanted to attend high school. So if your district did not have a high school, you still had to pay then some other school for that student to attend that high school. So that then leads to the creation of more high schools across the state. High schools go back to the 1860s in Iowa, but they're not common except in larger communities, really. And so in 1910, there were 406 high schools across the state. Just in 20 years as part of that progressive era, it's over 900 high schools in the state. So really that 1910 to 1930 period pre-Depression is the push to create high schools in Iowa.
There's also this recognition, or at least a belief in that same time period, that Iowa has too many schools. And so the push for consolidation, which we know continues today and has been pushed in many different ways over the decades, but that first push for consolidation really begins in the 1910s. Tell me about that.
Sure. As again, the progressive era in the United States really is, you know, the period of President Theodore Roosevelt into the Taft presidency and to a degree the Wilson presidency that lasts to 1921. And the idea that experts can help guide the training all across the United States culture and systems. And so you see that there's an effort in the late 1800s, early 1900s, say, you know what, maybe these individual schools, as good as they are not the best way. These one-room schools are not the best way to educate large groups of students when there's one teacher for all eight grades. And so the idea, they were called graded schools, and graded schools go back to the 1850s and 60s in Iowa, where you get taught by maybe one or two teachers taking a couple of grades, as opposed to one teacher teaching all grades. And so through the 19-teens, and in fact, the first woman to hold statewide office, Mae Francis, she becomes state superintendent in 1921. She is recognizing that we need to standardize and make sure these small schools are meeting the standards that we expect, but also she thinks they're valuable, and she gets primaried then 4 years later from another side of the Republican Party and only serves one term as our state superintendent. So that tension is going back to, are one-room schools good or not in the 1920s and of course continues through the 1940s into the post-World War II era.
Right. I know that some of my teachers when I was growing up, again in the 1980s, were educated in one-room schools. So that transition was not quick. And of course, with rural areas of Iowa, they were still a necessity for a long time, at least until busing became a really reliable thing that people could depend on. There also was a standard, an education standard, that graduating from the eighth grade meant that you were fully educated. And as we pushed for more high schools, we also started pushing for more students to get that kind of schooling. Tell me about that shift.
That really is part of that progressive era, that an educated population beyond just the elementary school level is critical to the, you know, progress in American life, that you need to have more than a high school education. And it's part of, you know, the country life movement that is broader in the early 20th century on how do you, you know, have a satisfying rural life for students. Well, you need to have cultural activities in your community, and you need to be able to speak intelligently. And it makes a better citizen is the idea, too, that, you know, you can weigh evidence and make the best decisions, especially in 1920 as women in Iowa get the vote, that having an educated population beyond elementary school is important. So really that movement that takes off in the late 1890s becomes critical as part of the systems that the state of Iowa sets up in the 19-teens.
We are talking about the history of public education in the state of Iowa with me, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum. And Leo, so this push for high school education to make it available and to encourage students to take advantage of it, that also really took off after World War II, this idea that, okay, now an eighth grade education is not good enough.
Exactly right. And just to, you know, talk a little bit about what those one-room schools were like, as good as they were generally short, abbreviated lessons where a teacher would say to all the, you know, first graders, work on your spelling assignment to learn how to spell, you know, words that rhyme with at, and do that for 15 minutes. And then she would call up those four or five students and drill them on their lesson while other students were working on their assignments, and just work through the different grade levels. And so it was a good, solid education in many cases, but it really was just getting to the basics. And then as, you know, science and humanities become equally important and basics of education through the post-World War II with the GI Bill and community colleges coming in, then in the late 1950s, early 1960s, having even higher level of expertise going from high school to expanding college access really is part of our state's legacy, too, where we've got some great public universities and great private colleges, too, and really great community colleges.
And that wasn't an instant shift, that push for kids to continue on through high school, that took a long time. I actually checked in with my dad, who graduated from Ogden High School in 1962. And he says that when he was in eighth grade, when he graduated from eighth grade, there were 81 kids in his class. When he graduated from high school, there were 54 kids in his class. So, and that's not because they moved away, but that's because even in 1962 or you know, the right around 1960, there were a lot of people who felt like an eighth grade education was good enough.
And part of that also relates to the mechanization in agriculture for boys, too, that takes place in the 1930s, 1940s, that, you know, if you're hand-picking corn in the fall in 1930 or 1940, you're not going to be able to go to school year-round. And once you've got the high school education, may not, or that elementary level education may not be important to go to high school and get the high school degree. But as tractors and machine farming become more and more common, especially after 1946, you do see more people living in town than on farms in Iowa. That takes place in 1960, I think, is the first census where we've got more people in town. And so right about the time your dad is graduating, you see those transitions in Iowa going from being a rural state to a more town and urban state happening. So that's part of the, you know, social, cultural, technological changes that happen that make school more accessible through the late 60s, early 1970s.
Well, and as I mentioned earlier, we know that a number of baby boomers, of course, still very much with us in Iowa today, did go to one-room schools in Iowa. After World War II, did we see those schools pretty much disappear?
That's correct. And as the recognition that the efficiencies of consolidated schools, the opportunities offered by a consolidated school, and as you referenced, the creation of reliable transportation that could take students in buses from a smaller township school area, even in the post-World War II baby boom, getting bused to consolidated school. If you lived outside of town, you know, if you're in Eden Township in Benton County, you could get taken into Vinton easily to go to the consolidated high school rather than relying on the local school to do that work.
Well, I know that you and I, Leo, are contemporaries, so we both grew up in Iowa in those 80s, and we both heard over and over and over again that Iowa has the best schools in the nation. So let's talk just a little bit about that golden age of education in Iowa. Of course, you know, those lists are due to a lot of different factors, but what made Iowa schools so-called the gold standard during that time?
Well, we did. We had such a high literacy rate. So those one-room schools and the consolidated schools first were good at teaching the basics. And so from the 1950s into the 1960s, we've got a very literate population. We're also very homogeneous for the most part. You don't see a lot of students in that 1930 to 1975 era with English not being their first language. So most of us were English language speakers in our state, a much higher proportion than today. Plus, you keep in mind, I think the test that is the Iowa Basic Skills Test is our state's test that was used nationally. So we scored well on a test developed in our state.
Right. We've learned a lot about cultural bias with standardized tests over the years. So we wrote the test for ourselves.
Exactly right. I mean, if you're a Simpsons fan, when they, you know, make fun of standardized testing, they often show the test being sent off to somewhere in Iowa. And then you think of the ACT also being an Iowa test. So when you see those two standards being used, our students, because most of the students in that period, 1947 to 1975, really are native speakers of English in our state. So not the challenges that a teacher has with, and our state is richer for the immigration we've had since the Asian immigration of the 1970s and then much of the Hispanic and African and Central European immigration that's come in. It's presented new challenges again for our educators. So our standardized testing scores may have suffered a little bit, but we still have a solid education system in our state too.
Right, right. And I'll reemphasize that we're not saying that the diversity in our state that has increased in some really wonderful ways over the decades is bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it made things less uniform. And some of those metrics then have been different.
Exactly right. That, again, if you're a first-generation English speaker, if your parents don't speak English, and you're doing that education system in our state as a refugee from wars in Asia or Africa or Central America, you're not going to be starting at the same level as a student who was in Iowa in 1970 and whose parents, you know, maybe are first or second generation, but you grew up in an English-speaking household, and our state is much richer in its diversity in the last 50 years. And again, as we both are saying, that's great for our state. Pre-1924, you know, we had so many different languages being spoken in our state. It would shock us today. People were complaining in the 1920s about German still being spoken in Iowa to Governor Harding. So it's an age-old complaint.
Well, Leo Landis, thank you for bringing us up to the 90s. We're going to pick up there with Margaret Buckton in just a moment. But Leo, thank you so much for being here.
It's always a treat, Charity, and great to talk to your listeners.
Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum, and we will continue our conversation about public education in Iowa in just a moment. We'll talk about some of the major changes to funding and just how public schools work in Iowa that have changed our schools over the last decades. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the history of public education in Iowa, something that Iowa and Iowans have always taken a great deal of pride in. And with me now is Margaret Buckton. She's been working in school finance, legislation, and lobbying for the past 20 years. She is a partner with Iowa School Finance Information Services. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for the ability to be here today.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start, this is a little bit of overlap with Leo, but one of the foundations of public education in Iowa, we've talked about some of the sweeping changes that were made by legislation, but one of the foundations is local control in this state. And if you look at the Department of Education website, that is highlighted on the very first page right now. Let's talk about the importance of local control in the development of public schools in Iowa.
You bet. So even though we've had a state funding formula that includes state and local property taxes since the 70s, the decisions on how that money has been spent have been made by locally elected school board members. And Iowa has long prided itself on its local control. What I would say, though, is in the last 30 years, the state has gotten more directive in requiring certain funds to be spent in certain ways. So we have a lot of these things called categorical funds, and you have to spend the money on that category and then report that you did that. So just in the last three decades, even though we still pride ourselves on being a local control state, there's less local control than we used to have.
Well, and less in the past year as well. We've seen a definite move away from that from Governor Reynolds. Let's talk about some of the funding changes that were made in the early 1990s. That's kind of where Leo and I left off. And there was a fairly big shift then. Tell me about that.
You betcha. So I want to back up one more year because in 1989, we actually started open enrollment in Iowa, which was a big change in the ability of parents to choose what school their children would go to. And they could open enroll into a neighboring public school. I think it was the partnership with that and having good quality private schools in the state that initially created some what we are calling today competition or incentive to improve schools. And today we have over 32,000 students in the state that open enroll to a neighboring district, and just fewer than that that are in private schools. after we got into the 90s, some of the changes that happened, we had the creation of the Student Achievement Teacher Quality Act. And that was a piece of legislation that put money into teacher salaries through these categorical funds I was talking about, also into teacher training, and added a day of funding for professional development. And the whole focus on that was, how do we give teachers the skills they need to reach this growing demographic and diverse population that we had for students?
Well, and we also had a funding formula that had been in place for a long time that was kind of on autopilot until the early 90s, right?
You bet. In 1993. So before that, the formula worked by actually having a calculation, and it looked at growth in property value in the state and inflation factors, growth in cost of benefits, and it kind of spit out a number and said, "Oh, we're going to increase the cost per pupil by whatever percent it was." And in the 80s, that was even double digits sometimes, as we had big inflation. In 1992, you're probably old enough to remember the Pac-Man game that was the video game, right? In 1992, the language they used at the State House was that the school aid was Pac-Manning the state budget, because we were growing enrollment. You know, all the baby boomers like me were in school, and that enrollment was growing, and it was becoming more and more expensive for the state share. So in 1992, they got rid of that automatic pilot and put in place the priority. They were going to set that cost per pupil number that would determine the budget for schools, but in a year ahead of the school year, having the school year start. So schools would basically get 18 months notice on what their budget would be, and it was done before the fiscal year and all the other budget decisions were made for the rest of the state government. So it really was the priority in that it was first, way ahead of other decisions. Then we kind of fast forward to later, after 2009, we go into a recession. It takes a while to pull out of that. Just a few years ago, they got rid of that requirement to do it in a year ahead of time. So for the last several years now, there's a 30-day deadline from the time the governor releases her budget until the school aid decision is supposed to be made. That 30 days this year is February 12th.
Okay, so we're looking forward to that.
We're coming up. Yeah.
Right. So how has that altered school funding? I mean, obviously, if it was in response to legislators feeling like too much money was going to schools, that decreased the amount of money that was going to schools, right?
Yeah, well, I think the way to think about it, when the decision was made first without considering anything else the state was going to be funding, I think that the track record of the legislature was a higher percentage. It typically averaged 3 to 4%. In the last decade, with those changes in timing, it's averaged about 1.8% increase in the cost per student. And that, what that means is that the schools have normal cost increases in everything they do, just like we do as consumers. They have increase in their utility budgets. It costs more to pay for staff benefits. If you don't have competitive salary increases for your staff, you'll lose your staff to all kinds of other places in Iowa that are hiring educated people, which our teachers happen to be. So those inflationary costs of doing the business of school typically run 3 to 3.5% if you have no change in enrollment. For our school districts with declining enrollment, they have to figure out how to cut the budget. So even though you'll hear the legislature say, we haven't cut schools, we're putting more and more state aid into schools every year in the last 10 years, the way that works out through application of the formula is that we have, as many as 50 schools that actually see a decrease in resources available.
Now, Leo and I were talking about sort of the original consolidation of schools in Iowa. Iowa has gone through a number of consolidations of schools. And of course, people who live in small towns have a front row seat to how this has happened over the years. So walk me briefly through consolidation, particularly of rural districts, and how we've seen that transform our schools.
You bet. So when Leo talked about it, back in the 50s, we had 4,650 plus school districts. And then the requirement of having a high school and some of those other policies drove consolidation. I'd say in the last 15 to 20 years, consolidation has been really driven by two things. One of those is the failure of that cost per student to keep up with the cost that schools experience. And the second one is additional requirements that are put on schools that especially very small schools have trouble meeting those accreditation requirements. So back in the 90s, about the time I think when Governor Vilsack was in office, we increased graduation requirements so that all students have to have 4 English credits and 3 each of math, science, and social studies. And fast forward to the last 4 or 5 years, we've added a requirement for a financial literacy course, a computer science course. The computer science course doesn't have to be taken by all students, but school districts have to offer it. All students have to take CPR training. And there are other things that happen that get added to the requirements that schools provide. And that's made it difficult for smaller school districts that don't have that economy of scale or can't find certified teachers to teach the subjects that are required. So now we're down to 327.
And that has, of course, radically changed our relationships with these schools as well. I mean, the school used to be the heart of the identity of a community. And now it's very important to the families who have students who are going there. But there's less of that deep connection, isn't there?
I think that's true, Charity. I think that, you know, we have some school districts that are as big as an entire county in the state, and it's really hard for schools to maintain. You can't have a high school in all those little towns you used to. You may be able to have elementary schools kind of scattered throughout the county, but it's harder because of distance from, you know, where the football game is or where you might have the band concert or the other reasons why the public may have engaged in those school activities. Still, I would say the school is the heart of the community, but we have a bigger sense of what that community means. And I think it's harder to communicate to those that are further removed from the attendance center.
Well, and this year, I feel, has really pointed out how very different it is to operate a rural school district and an urban school district in the state of Iowa. There are so many things that have become so clear in this pandemic year, and that's one of them. So let's talk a little bit about the differences, because I know you work with urban districts and rural districts.
You bet. So in the last 3 years, the legislature has actually invested in a transportation equity fund that has helped rural districts tremendously. Before that fund was in place, the average cost per student in today's formula, the $7,048 is the cost per pupil. In some of our rural districts, before that transportation fund was there, they might be spending as much as $1,200 per pupil enrolled just to get them to the door. And that left, you know, less resource for teachers and textbooks and technology and all those things. That money going into the transportation formula, that $27 million, is hugely important to those districts that have big transportation costs. And that's one thing that's very different between rural and urban districts, is how much it costs to bus kids to the door. Another inequity is in the way the formula works. Some school districts are kept at that minimum of that state cost per pupil, and others can go as much as $155 per student more, and that's times every student in the school district. That's on local property taxes, but it's more resource. And depending on where you are, that could be an urban district, that could be a rural district, but you have more money. So there's been an effort at the legislature the last 3 years to close that gap. Now 155, it used to be higher. And we expect they'll keep working on that. The other things that they have in common, before I get to differences, would be poverty, which has really changed in Iowa. Back in the early 2000s, we would be surprised to see more than 21% of the students in a school district on free and reduced price lunch. Now the statewide average is over 40%. But in our urban districts, we might see 65-75% of our students eligible for free and reduced price lunch. There are some rural schools, especially the southern tier of Iowa, that have similar rates of poverty. And that costs more to educate students. I'm not saying you can't educate students with poverty. Of course you can. And we've got some schools that are doing a great job of that. But it takes more resource. You might need to have more social workers or counselors. You might need to have smaller class sizes or supports for parents. It takes a different school structure to effectively meet the needs of those students. And then in urban schools, we have that it's urban density, right? We have more people per square mile, or you get into a big high school, more people per square foot. And just being able to maintain in our COVID environment a safe social distance and have the resources to clean every night at the end of the day, that's hugely different if your class size in an urban high school class might be 32 to 35 students compared to a rural class that might have 15 to 20.
We were talking earlier about the tremendous amount of pride in the 80s and 90s in our school rankings, et cetera. There's still a great deal of pride in Iowa public schools, and they still perform very well. So just give me a thumbnail sketch about how Iowa schools match up to other schools around the nation today.
You got. So Iowa is number one in the nation in our graduation rate. So it's fun to hear Leo talk about the 50s and 60s when, you didn't expect to graduate from high school. Now we're at 91.6%. And even in our urban centers at 85 to 90%, which is extraordinarily better than urban schools around the rest of the country. We are number one in the nation in the college credit given during high school on a per student basis, which is really something to celebrate when you're looking at those tuition bills as a parent. If your student can go to school as a, one semester under their belt, it's great. And I also think that creates that sense of everybody can go to college because we have access to it in our high schools. We're in the top three almost every year in our ACT scores. That's the college entrance exam for those states in which more than 50% of the students take it. And that's a testament to the content, the quality of the content that students are getting in high school that shows they're college ready. And we have in our schools more students taking higher level coursework. When you look at the Condition of Education report every year, more students taking calculus and advanced physics, those kinds of courses that we know prepare them for success in whatever they're going to do when they graduate. I think the other thing that's interesting that Iowa has that not all states have, it began in 2010, but we have basically a universal free preschool program. It's called the Statewide Voluntary Preschool Program. And four-year-olds can attend that. It's in partnership with public and private schools. And we typically have about 32,000 kindergarten or four-year-olds who have had that quality preschool program when they go into kindergarten. And the data tells you that will help students be more proficient in reading, be less likely to get a special education designation later in their school career, make them less dependent on the state after they graduate from high school and college. So it's a way that our state has invested in those good outcomes for students.
Now, we only have a moment left, and I want to mention that coming up on Monday on River to River at noon here on Iowa Public Radio, we will be doing an in-depth look at the changes that are being proposed right now in Des Moines to Iowa's public school system. But before we have to leave, Margaret, the idea of a student enrolling in a private school and having public money follow that student to that school, that's the big departure for how we've run our public schools and funded our public schools in Iowa.
Yes, it really is that it's both a lack of accountability, not that the private school isn't accountable to parents, but it isn't accountable to taxpayers. And you can't see any of the contracts that they have out or what they pay their staff or approve their bill paid list like we can for our public school districts. But the other thing about that I think is different, there's been data that says that kids might do better in a private school. One of those comparison plans in Ohio has a similar kind of a voucher for those students that are in schools labeled by the federal program as in need of assistance. In Ohio, they actually require the private school to test students and to break down demographically so you can see how low-income kids do or minority kids do or kids that don't speak English. And when they do those comparisons, they don't have data showing that students do better in the private school. We don't have that kind of accountability in this proposed law. And so the taxpayer dollars leave with the student, but even the parent doesn't know if the school they're going to with the private dollars are going to will deliver better results for the child.
Margaret Buckton, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Margaret Buckton has been working in school finance, legislation, and lobbying for the past 20 years. She's a partner with Iowa School Finance Information Services. And again, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the proposals to changing public schools in Iowa on Monday on River to River at noon with Ben Kiefer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Neppe.